Jean smiled back at him and gently dislodged her hand from his. "Just let me restore the circulation," she pleaded, rubbing her fingers. "I wish you'd believe me when I tell you I'm perfectly all right now." "Then what do you think happened? Surely you remember something." "No, it's just a complete blank. I heard Jan ask his question, and then you were all making a fuss over me. I'm sure it was some kind of trance. After all..." She paused, then decided not to tell George that this sort of thing had happened before. She knew how he felt about these matters, and had no desire to upset him further, and perhaps scare him away completely. "After all, what?" asked George.
"Oh, nothing.
I wonder what that overlord thought about the whole business. We probably gave him more material than he bargained for." Jean shivered slightly, and her eyes clouded.
"I'm afraid of the overlords, George. Oh, I don't mean they're evil or anything foolish like that. I'm sure they mean well and are doing what they think is best for us. I wonder just what their plans really are."
George shifted uncomfortably.
"Men have been wondering that ever since they came to Earth," he said. "They'll tell us when we're ready for it, and frankly, I'm not inquisitive. Besides, I've got more important things to bother about."
He turned towards Jean and grasped her hands.
"What about going to archives tomorrow and signing a contract for, let's say, 5 years?
Jean looked at him steadfastly and decided that, on the whole, she liked what she saw.
"Make it 10, she said.
Jan bided his time. There was no hurry, and he wanted to think. It was almost as if he feared to make any checks, lest the fantastic hope that had come into his mind be too swiftly destroyed. While he was still uncertain, he could at least dream. Moreover, to take any further action, he would have to see the observatory librarian. She knew him and his interests too well, and would certainly be intrigued by his request. Probably it would make no difference, but Jan was determined to leave nothing to chance. There would be a better opportunity in a week. He was being super cautious, he knew, but that added a schoolboy zest to the enterprise. Jan also feared ridicule quite as much as anything that the overlords might conceivably do to thwart him. If he was embarking on a wild goose chase, no one else would ever know. He had a perfectly good reason for going to London. The arrangements had been made weeks ago. Though he was too young and too unqualified to be a delegate, he was one of the three students who had managed to attach themselves to the official party going to the meeting of the International Astronomical Union. The vacancies had been there, and it seemed a pity to waste the opportunity, as he had not visited London since his childhood. He knew that very few of the dozens of papers to be delivered to the IAU would be of the slightest interest to him, even if he could understand them. Like a delegate to any scientific congress, he would attend the lectures that looked promising and spend the rest of the time talking with fellow enthusiasts or simply sightseeing. London had changed enormously in the last 50 years. It now contained scarcely 2 million people and 100 times as many machines. It was no longer a great port, for with every country producing almost all its needs, the entire pattern of world trade had been altered. There were some goods that certain countries still made best, but they went directly by air to their destinations. The trade routes that had once converged on the great harbors and later on the great airports had finally dispersed into an intricate webwork covering the whole world, with no major nodal points. Yet some things had not altered. The city was still a center of administration, of art, of learning. In these matters, none of the continental capitals could rival it, not even Paris, despite many claims to the contrary. A Londoner from a century before could still have found his way around, at least in the city's center, with no difficulty. There were new bridges over the Thames, but in the old places. The great, grimy railway stations had gone, banished to the suburbs. But the Houses of Parliament were unchanged. Nelson's solitary eye still stared down Whitehall. The dome of St. Paul's still stood above Ludgate Hill, though now there were taller buildings to challenge its preeminence. And the guard still marched in front of Buckingham Palace. All these things, thought Jan, could wait. It was vacation time, and he was lodged with his two fellow students in one of the university hostels. Bloomsbury also had not changed its character in the last century. It was still an island of hotels and boarding houses, though they no longer jostled each other so closely, or formed such endless, identical rows of soot-coated brick. It was not until the second day of the Congress that Chan got his opportunity. The main papers were being read in the great assembly chamber of the Science Center, not far from the concert hall that had done so much to make London the musical metropolis of the world. Chan wanted to hear the first of the day's lectures, which, it was rumored, would completely demolish the current theory of the formation of the planets. Perhaps it did, but Chan was little the wiser when he left after the interval. He hurried down to the directory and looked up the rooms he wanted. Some humorous civil servant had put the Royal Astronomical Society on the top floor of the great building, a gesture which the council members fully appreciated as it gave them a magnificent view across the Thames and over the entire northern part of the city. There seemed to be nobody around, but Chan, clutching his membership card like a passport in case he was challenged, had no difficulty in locating the library. It took him almost an hour to find what he wanted, and to learn how to handle the great star catalogs with their millions of entries. He was trembling slightly as he neared the end of his quest, and felt glad that there was no one around to see his nervousness. He put the catalog back among its fellows, and for a long time sat quite still, staring sightlessly at the wall of volumes before him. Then he slowly walked out into the still corridors, past the secretary's office. There was somebody there now, busily unpacking parcels of books, and down the stairs. He avoided the elevator, for he wanted to be free and unconfined. There was another lecture he had intended to hear, but that was no longer important now. His thoughts were still in turmoil as he crossed to the embankment wall and let his eye follow the Thames on its unhurried way to the sea. It was hard for anyone with his training in orthodox science to accept the evidence that had now come into his hands. He could never be certain of its truth, yet the probability was overwhelming. As he paced slowly beside the river wall, he marshaled the facts one by one. Fact one. No one at Rupert's party could possibly have known that he was going to ask that question. He had not known it himself. It had been a spontaneous reaction to the circumstances. Therefore, no one could have prepared any answer, or had it already lying in their minds. Fact 2. NGS 549672 probably meant nothing to anyone except an astronomer. Though the great National Geographic Survey had been completed half a century before, its existence was known only to a few thousand specialists, and taking any number from it at random, no one could have said where that particular star lay in the heavens. But, and this was fact three, which he had only this moment discovered, the small and insignificant star known as NGS 549672 was in precisely the right place. It lay in the heart of the constellation Carina, at the end of that shining trail Jan himself had seen so few nights ago, leading from the solar system out across the depths of space. It was an impossible coincidence. NGS 549672 must be the home of the overlords. Yet to accept the fact violated all Jan's cherished ideas of scientific method. Very well, let them be violated. He must accept the fact that, somehow, Rupert's fantastic experiment had tapped a hitherto unknown source of knowledge. Rashavaric? That seemed the most probable explanation. The Overlord had not been in the circle, but that was a minor point. However, Jan was not concerned with the mechanism of paraphysics. He was only interested in using the results. Very little was known about NGS 549672. There had been nothing to distinguish it from a million other stars. But the catalog gave its magnitude, its coordinates, and its spectral type. Jan would have to do a little research and make a few simple calculations. Then he would know, at least approximately, how far the world of the overlords was from Earth. A slow smile spread over Jan's face as he turned away from the Thames, back towards the gleaming white facade of the Science Center. Knowledge was power, and he was the only man on Earth who knew the origin of the Overlords. How he would use that knowledge he could not guess. It would lie safely in his mind, awaiting the moment of destiny. Chapter 10. The human race continued to bask in the long, cloudless summer afternoon of peace and prosperity. Would there ever be a winter again? It was unthinkable. The Age of Reason, prematurely welcomed by the leaders of the French Revolution 2.5 centuries before, had now really arrived. This time, there was no mistake. There were drawbacks, of course, though they were willingly accepted. One had to be very old indeed to realize that the papers which the Telecaster printed in every home were really rather dull. Gone were the crises that had once produced banner headlines. There were no mysterious murders to baffle the police and to arouse in a million breasts the moral indignation that was often suppressed envy. Such murders as did occur were never mysterious. It was only necessary to turn a dial, and the crime could be seen reenacted. That instruments capable of such feats existed had at first caused considerable panic among quite law-abiding people. This was something that the overlords, who had mastered most but not all the quirks of human psychology, had not anticipated. It had to be made perfectly clear that no peeping Tom would be able to spy on his fellows, and that the very few instruments in human hands would be under strict control. Rupert Boyce's projector, for instance, could not operate beyond the borders of the reservation, so he and Maya were the only persons inside its range. Even the few serious crimes that did occur received no particular attention in the news. For well-bred people do not, after all, care to read about the social gaffes of others. The average working week was now 20 hours, but those 20 hours were no sinecure. There was little work left of a routine, mechanical nature. Men's minds were too valuable to waste on tasks that a few thousand transistors, some photoelectric cells, and a cubic meter of printed circuits could perform. There were factories that ran for weeks without being visited by a single human being. Men were needed for troubleshooting, for making decisions, for planning new enterprises. The robots did the rest. The existence of so much leisure would have created tremendous problems a century before. Education had overcome most of these, for a well-stocked mind is safe from boredom. The general standard of culture was at a level which would once have seemed fantastic. There was no evidence that the intelligence of the human race had improved, but for the first time everyone was given the fullest opportunity of using what brain he had. Most people had two homes in widely separated parts of the world. Now that the polar regions had been opened up, a considerable fraction of the human race oscillated from Arctic to Antarctic at 6-monthly intervals, seeking the long, nightless polar summer. Others had gone into the deserts, up the mountains, or even into the sea. There was nowhere on the planet where science and technology could not provide one with a comfortable home, if one wanted it badly enough. Some of the more eccentric dwelling places provided the few items of excitement in the news. In the most perfectly ordered society, there will always be accidents. Perhaps it was a good sign that people felt it worthwhile to risk, and occasionally break, their necks for the sake of a cozy villa tucked under the summit of Everest, or looking out through the spray of Victoria Falls. As a result, someone was always being rescued from somewhere. It had become a kind of game, almost a planetary sport. People could indulge in such whims because they had both the time and the money. The abolition of armed forces had at once almost doubled the world's effective wealth, and increased production had done the rest. As a result, it was difficult to compare the standard of living of 21st century man with that of any of his predecessors. Everything was so cheap that the necessities of life were free, provided as a public service by the community, as roads, water, street lighting, and drainage had once been. A man could travel anywhere he pleased, eat whatever food he fancied, without handing over any money. He had earned the right to do this by being a productive member of the community. There were, of course, some drones, but the number of people sufficiently strong-willed to indulge in a life of complete idleness is much smaller than is generally supposed. Supporting such parasites was considerably less of a burden than providing for the armies of ticket collectors, shop assistants, bank clerks, stockbrokers, and so forth, whose main function, when one took the global point of view, was to transfer items from one ledger to another. Nearly a quarter of the human race's total activity, it had been calculated, was now expended on sports of various kinds, ranging from such sedentary occupations as chess to lethal pursuits like ski gliding across mountain valleys. One unexpected result of this was the extinction of the professional sportsman. There were too many brilliant amateurs, and the changed economic conditions had made the old system obsolete. Next to sport, entertainment, in all its branches, was the greatest single industry. For more than 100 years, there had been people who had believed that Hollywood was the center of the world. They could now make a better case for this claim than ever before, but it was safe to say that most of 2050's productions would have seemed incomprehensibly highbrow to 1950. There had been some progress. The box office was no longer lord of all it surveyed. Yet among all the distractions and diversions of a planet which now seemed well on the way to becoming one vast playground, there were some who still found time to repeat an ancient and never answered question. Where do we go from here? Chapter 11. Jan leaned against the elephant and rested his hands on the skin, rough as the bark of a tree. He looked up at the great tusks and the curving trunk, caught by the skill of the taxidermist in the moment of challenge or salutation. What still weirder creatures, he wondered, from what unknown worlds would one day be looking at this exile from Earth? "How many animals have you sent to the overlords?" he asked Rupert.
"At least 50, though of course this is the biggest one. He's magnificent, isn't he? Most of the others have been quite small, butterflies, snakes, monkeys, and so on, though I did get a hippo last year."
Jan gave a wry smile.
"It's a morbid thought, but I suppose they've got a fine stuffed group of Homo sapiens in their collection by this time. I wonder who was honored."
"You're probably right," said Rupert, rather indifferently.
"It would be easy to arrange through the hospitals."
"What would happen," continued Jan thoughtfully, "if someone volunteered to go as a live specimen, assuming that an eventual return was guaranteed, of course?"
Rupert laughed, though not unsympathetically.
"Is that an offer? Shall I put it to Rashavarik?"
For a moment, Jan considered the idea more than half seriously. Then he shook his head.
No. I was only thinking out loud. They'd certainly turn me down. By the way, do you ever see Rashavarik these days?"
"He called me up about 6 weeks ago. He'd just found a book I'd been hunting. Rather nice of him."
Jan walked slowly around the stuffed monster, admiring the skill that had frozen it forever at this instant of greatest vigor.
"Did you ever discover what he was looking for?" he asked. "I mean, it seems so hard to reconcile the Overlord's science with an interest in the occult."
Rupert looked at Jan a little suspiciously, wondering if his brother-in-law was poking fun at his hobby.
"His explanation seemed adequate. As an anthropologist, he was interested in every aspect of our culture. Remember, they have plenty of time. They can go into more detail than a human research worker ever could. Reading my entire library probably put only a slight strain on Rashi's resources."
That might be the answer, but Jan was not convinced. Sometimes he had thought of confiding his secret to Rupert, but his natural caution had held him back. When he met his overlord friend again, Rupert would probably give something away. The temptation would be far too great.
"Incidentally," said Rupert, changing the subject abruptly, "if you think this is a big job, you should see the commission Sullivan's got. He's promised to deliver the two biggest creatures of all, a sperm whale and a giant squid. They'll be shown locked in mortal combat. What a tableau that will make."
For a moment, Jan did not answer. The idea that had exploded in his mind was too outrageous, too fantastic to be taken seriously. Yet, because of its very daring, it might succeed.
"What's the matter?" said Rupert anxiously. "The heat getting you down?"
Jen shook himself back to present reality.
I'm all right, he said. I was just wondering how the overlords would collect a little packet like that.
Oh, said Rupert.
One of those cargo ships of theirs will come down, open a hatch, and hoist it in.
That, said Jan, is exactly what I thought. It might have been the cabin of a spaceship, but it was not. The walls were covered with meters and instruments. There were no windows, merely a large screen in front of the pilot. The vessel could carry 6 passengers, but at the moment, Jan was the only one. He was watching the screen intently, absorbing each glimpse of this strange and unknown region as it passed before his eyes. Unknown, yes, as unknown as anything he might meet beyond the stars if his mad plan succeeded. He was going into a realm of nightmare creatures, preying upon each other in a darkness undisturbed since the world began. It was a realm above which men had sailed for thousands of years. It lay no more than a kilometer below the keels of their ships. Yet until the last 100 years, they had known less about it than the visible face of the moon. The pilot was dropping down from the ocean heights towards the still unexplored vastness of the South Pacific Basin. He was following, Jan knew, the invisible grid of sound waves created by beacons along the ocean floor. They were still sailing as far above that floor as clouds above the surface of the earth. There was very little to see. The submarine's scanners were searching the waters in vain. The disturbance created by their jets had probably scared away the smaller fish. If any creature came to investigate, it would be something so large that it did not know the meaning of fear. The tiny cabin vibrated with power, the power which could hold at bay the immense weight of the waters above their heads and could create this little bubble of light and air within which men could live. If that power failed, thought Jan, they would become prisoners in a metal tomb, buried deep in the silt of the ocean bed.
Time to get a fix, said the pilot.
He threw a set of switches, and the submarine came to rest in a gentle surge of deceleration as the jets ceased their thrust. The vessel was motionless, floating in equilibrium as a balloon floats in the atmosphere. It took only a moment to check their position on the sonar grid. When he had finished with his instrument readings, the pilot remarked,
"Before we start the motors again, let's see if we can hear anything."
The loudspeaker flooded the quiet little room with a low, continuous murmur of sound. There was no outstanding noise that Jan could distinguish from the rest. It was a steady background, into which all individual sounds had been blended. He was listening, Jan knew, to the myriad creatures of the sea talking together. It was as if he stood in the center of a forest that teemed with life, except that there he would have recognized some of the individual voices. Here, not one thread in the tapestry of sound could be disentangled and identified. It was so alien, so remote from anything he had ever known that it set Jan's scalp crawling. And yet, this was part of his own world. The shriek cut across the vibrating background like a flash of lightning against a dark storm cloud. It faded swiftly away into a banshee wail, an ululation that dwindled and died, yet was repeated a moment later from a more distant source. Then a chorus of screams broke out, a pandemonium that caused the pilot to reach swiftly for the volume control.
"What in the name of God was that?" gasped Jan. "Weird, isn't it? It's a school of whales, about 10 kilometers away. I knew they were in the neighborhood and thought you'd like to hear them."
Jan shuddered.
"And I always thought the sea was silent. Why do they make such a din? Talking to one another, I suppose. Sullivan could tell you. They say he can even identify some individual whales, though I find that hard to believe. Hello, we've got company."
A fish with incredibly exaggerated jaws was visible in the viewing screen. It appeared to be quite large, but as Jan did not know the scale of the picture, it was hard to judge. Hanging from a point just below its gills was a long tendril, ending in an unidentifiable bell-shaped organ.
"We're seeing it on infrared," said the pilot. "Let's look at the normal picture."
The fish vanished completely. Only the pendant remained, glowing with its own vivid phosphorescence. Then, just for an instant,
the shape of the creature flickered into visibility as a line of lights flashed on along its body. It's an angler. That's the bait it uses to lure other fish. Fantastic, isn't it? What I don't understand is, why doesn't his bait attract fish big enough to eat him? But we can't wait here all day. Watch him run when I switch on the jets. The cabin vibrated once again as the vessel eased itself forward. The great luminous fish suddenly flashed on all its lights in a frantic signal of alarm and departed like a meteor into the darkness of the abyss. It was after another 20 minutes of slow descent that the invisible fingers of the scanner beams caught the first glimpse of the ocean bed. Far beneath, a range of low hills was passing, their outlines curiously soft and rounded. Whatever irregularities they might once have possessed had long ago been obliterated by the ceaseless rain from the watery heights above. Even here, in mid-Pacific, far from the great estuaries that slowly swept the continents out to sea, that rain never ceased. It came from the storm-scarred flanks of the Andes, from the bodies of a billion living creatures, from the dust of meteors that had wandered through space for ages and had come at last to rest. Here in the eternal night, it was laying the foundations of the lands to be. The hills drifted behind. They were the frontier posts, as Jan could see from the charts, of a wide plain which lay at too great a depth for the scanners to reach. The submarine continued on its gentle downward glide. Now another picture was beginning to form on the screen. Because of the angle of view, it was some time before Jan could interpret what he saw. Then he realized that they were approaching a submerged mountain, jutting up from the hidden plain. The picture was clearer now. At this short range, the definition of the scanners improved, and the view was almost as distinct as if the image was being formed by light waves. Jan could see fine detail, could watch the strange fish that pursued each other among the rocks. Once, a venomous-looking creature with gaping jaws swam slowly across a half-concealed cleft. So swiftly that the eye could not follow the movement, a long tentacle flashed out and dragged the struggling fish down to its doom.
"Nearly there," said the pilot. "You'll be able to see the lab in a minute."
They were traveling slowly above a spur of rock, jutting out from the base of the mountain. The plain beneath was now coming into view. Jan guessed that they were not more than a few hundred meters above the seabed. Then he saw, a kilometer or so ahead, a cluster of spheres standing on tripod legs and joined together by connecting tubes. It looked exactly like the tanks of some chemical plant, and indeed was designed on the same basic principles. The only difference was that here the pressures which had to be resisted were outside, not within.
"What's that?" gasped Jan suddenly.
He pointed a shaky finger towards the nearest sphere. The curious pattern of lines on its surface had resolved itself into a network of giant tentacles. As the submarine came closer, he could see that they ended in a great, pulpy bag, from which peered a pair of enormous eyes.
"That," said the pilot indifferently, "is probably Lucifer. Someone's been feeding him again."
He threw a switch and leaned over the control desk.
"S2 calling lab. I'm connecting up. Will you shoo away your pet?"
The reply came promptly.
"Lab to S2. Okay. Go ahead and make contact. Lucy will get out of the way."
The curving metal walls began to fill the screen. Jan caught a last glimpse of a giant, sucker-studded arm whipping away at their approach. Then there was a dull clang and a series of scratching noises as the clamps sought for their locking points on the submarine's smooth, oval hull. In a few minutes, the vessel was pressed tightly against the wall of the base. The two entrance ports had locked together and were moving forward through the hull of the submarine at the end of a giant hollow screw. Then came the pressure-equalized signal, the hatches unsealed, and the way into Deep Sea Lab 1 was open. Jan found Professor Sullivan in a small, untidy room that seemed to combine the attributes of office, workshop, and laboratory. He was peeping through a microscope into what looked like a small bomb. Presumably it was a pressure capsule containing some specimen of deep-sea life, still swimming happily around under its normal tons-to-the-square-centimeter conditions.
"Well," said Sullivan,
dragging himself away from the eyepiece. How's Rupert? And what can we do for you?
Rupert's fine, replied Jan. He sends his best wishes, and says he'd love to visit you if it weren't for his claustrophobia.
Then he'd certainly feel a little unhappy down here, with 5 kilometers of water on top of him. Doesn't it worry you, by the way?
Jan shrugged his shoulders.
No more than being in a stratoliner. If anything went wrong, the result would be the same in either case.
That's the sensible approach, but it's surprising how few people see it that way.
Sullivan toyed with the controls of his microscope, then shot Jan an inquisitive glance.